Los Angeles is on fire.
About 100,000 structures been burned down, and they are calling it the most destructive in Los Angeles history.
Syrian refugees in Turkey have a difficult choice.
With Assad gone, the question of whether to return to Syria now looms large.
And a look at some of President-elect Donald Trump's recent statements and what they can tell us about his foreign policy plans.
As I say, it's part of his pretty tried and true tactics. You put the person on the other side of the deal you want to get on the back foot to try to strike a better deal.
Today is Thursday, January 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Los Angeles is the United States' second largest city by population, hailed by TV, movies, and music as a place of eternal sunshine and beauty. But today, Los Angeles is a scene of fire and destruction. Tens of thousands of people are under evacuation orders, and parts of the city are virtually surrounded by flames. Jeannie Adullo covers Los Angeles for VOA. She joins me on the phone.
Yes, so currently we are in Los Angeles County looking at three big fires. Pacific Palisades fire that had started late Tuesday morning at 10:30 with the winds at 40 miles per hour. It's 64 kilometers per hour. Since then, the fire has grown to more than 12,000 acres. We're talking about 50 square kilometers. About 100,000 structures have been burned down, and they are calling it the most destructive in Los Angeles history. Second in size, it's a Eaton fire near Pasadena. So there we have reported two deaths already, almost 44 square kilometers burned and 100 structures. Third one, which is closest to me, and I am hoping that it's not going to progress any further. We're talking about the Hearst fire at Silmar neighborhood, and it is 2 square kilometer fire. So overall, it was prompted. You know, we woke up early in the morning, yesterday, Tuesday morning, to a very fast and intense wind. We're talking about 80 miles per hour, which is over 128 kilometers per hour. And with the dry vegetation, we really didn't have much rain this year. And it's very dry. And yet it's all prompted this huge fire activity. And it's very unpredictable. It's moving fast and people are fleeing. And it's been a disaster. I don't think Los Angeles remembers that something like this in its history.
Have the authorities been able to say what started the fires?
They are saying it is under the investigation, and they are going to be looking into that. I'm not sure how possible it is would be to locate the single reason, but overall, we're talking about those conditions, again, being dry, fast, very fast winds. I don't remember these fast winds, you know, in my 10 years living in California, so that would be the main cause of spreading, at least.
Jeannie, we know that tens of thousands of people are being forced to evacuate, asked to evacuate. What has the city's mayor, the state's governor, said?
There are 70,000 people currently under the evacuation order. California governor has declared the state of emergency. As a matter of fact, President Biden, yesterday he was visiting, and he is still visiting Los Angeles, and he was actually planning to go to Palm Desert to designate the new national monument in the Coachella Valley, but he canceled those plans and stayed behind. So we heard the press conference when he was talking to he visited one of the Santa Monica fire departments, so he spoke to them. As I mentioned, California National Guard is deployed, and also Pentagon deployed Navy helicopters with water delivery to help fight fires. But there is an issue with the strong winds that complicate any kind of flying.
Jeannie Adullo covers Los Angeles for the Voice of America. Jeannie, thanks for your reporting today. Thanks for your help.
Thank you so much, Steve.
With the overthrow of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Turkey sees an opportunity to send home up to 4 million Syrian refugees who fled during Syria's civil war amid growing public hostility toward the refugees. Many of those interviewed in Istanbul, however, have formed new lives in Turkey and say that with no guarantees of safety or livelihood, they are not ready to return. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Syrian refugee Hasan Salaroğlu and his family have carved out a new life in Istanbul with a thriving pastry shop in Istanbul's Sultanbeyli district, which is home to around 60,000 Syrians. With Assad gone, the question of whether to return to Syria now looms large, says Syrian refugee Hasan Salaroğlu.
It's been 10 years, and my shop has been open for the last 8 years. We can start a shop there in Syria.
Across the road, clothes shop owner Emel Denyal is considering a return to her home in Aleppo, but says such a move could mean breaking up her family.
We are all thinking about returning, but the children don't think about it. They love being here. They want to stay here. We still feel nostalgic for our land. We are still missing Syria because we were raised in Syria. The Syrian generation growing up in Turkey doesn't think about going back.
Since Assad fled Syria, Turkish authorities say about 35,000 Syrians out of nearly 4 million living in Turkey have gone home. The Refugee Association in Sultanbeyli provides assistance to some of Istanbul's 600,000 Syrian refugees. Social Welfare Director Kadri Gungurul says Syrians are becoming increasingly nervous about returning.
The desire to return was very strong in the first stage, but has turned into this. Yes, we will return, but there is no infrastructure, no education, and no hospitals. But if the Syrians do not return, the general public may react to the Syrians because now they will say that Syria is safe. Why don't you return?
Turkish authorities have removed Arabic from shop signs in a move aimed at quelling growing public resentment over Syrian refugees, made worse by an ailing economy. Mesut Jarsham, a Turkish presidential adviser, is a professor of international relations at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
It is bringing a lot of the problems in Turkey, even the criminal actions and also border security, and Turkish public opinion opposed the Syrian people in today.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is promising to facilitate the quick return of Syrian refugees while pledging that deportations will be voluntary. However, analysts suggest stronger action may be possible, as Erdogan knows that not sending the refugees home quickly could have political consequences. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And sticking with Syria, a lot has changed since the fall of the Assad government, and if some in the EU have their way, those changes will extend to European sanctions put in place under the old regime. The hope there is that lifting the sanctions will give the country's economy a much-needed boost. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has our story.
France said on Wednesday some European Union sanctions on Syria could be lifted soon. A month after the end of Assad family rule, those sanctions are hindering the country's recovery and obstructing the delivery of humanitarian aid. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot added that lifting more political sanctions would depend on how Syria's new leadership handled the transition and ensured inclusivity. In Damascus, Mohamed Badr said Syria's ailing economy and standard of living needed a boost.
The situation is way better than before, but there are some observations. First of all, people are tired. I totally respect all the new decisions. I respect everything that is happening. And I respect those who are working seriously. I respect everything. But the problem is that people are tired and people's incomes are low.
International flights have resumed for the first time since rebels toppled Bashar al-Assad on December 8th, and reunited families hugged and cried with joy. Bassem al-Hariri said he hadn't been back for more than a decade.
I'm a dissident police officer. I left Syria in 2012 and have not returned since then. I cannot describe my happiness. I needed a miracle to return via Damascus International Airport, and that miracle happened.
Life has also returned for the first time in many years to Mount Qasiun, a much-loved viewpoint overlooking Damascus. A view of Syria's future is less clear. There are severe power shortages, with state-supplied electricity available only 2 or 3 hours per day in most areas. The trade minister in the caretaker government said on Monday that sanctions have been preventing Syria from making deals to import fuel, wheat and other key goods. Three European diplomats, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the EU would agree to lift some sanctions by the time the bloc's foreign ministers meet in late January. Two of the diplomats said one aim was to facilitate financial transactions to allow funds to return to the country, ease air transport, and lessen sanctions targeting the energy sector to improve power supplies. The United States on Monday issued a sanctions exemption for transactions with governing institutions in Syria for 6 months.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting for us. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
An Italian journalist detained in Iran for 3 weeks has been freed and returned home. A plane carrying Cecilia Sala landed Wednesday at Rome's Ciampino Airport, where Premier Giorgia Meloni was on hand to welcome her alongside Sala's family members. Sala's liberation marked a major diplomatic and political victory for Meloni, whose recent visit with President-elect Trump at his Mar-a-Lago, Florida retreat greatly enhanced her stature internationally at a time when Italy was negotiating Sala's release.
Turkey has again insisted on a two-state peace accord in ethnically divided Cyprus as the UN prepares to meet with all sides in early spring. The UN-led meeting is in hopes of restarting formal talks to resolve one of the world's most intractable conflicts. The most recent major push for a peace deal collapsed in 2017. The UN, the European Union, and others have rejected a two-state deal. They say the only way forward is a federation agreement with Turkish Cypriot and Greek Cypriot zones.
The U.S. government did not pay the more than $3.6 million due to the World Anti-Doping Agency in 2024, making good on a long-running threat anchored in unhappiness with the global watchdog's handling of cases involving Chinese swimmers and others.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Looking now at the presidential transition here in the U.S. in less than 2 weeks, on January 6th, President Joe Biden announced a prohibition on offshore drilling in most U.S. coastal waters. President-elect Trump says he'll undo all that when he takes office on the 20th. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has more.
The benefits of offshore drilling just aren't worth the risks to the environment, health, and economy, says President Joe Biden, especially as the nation moves toward a clean energy economy. So, on January 6th, Biden announced a sweeping new ban on future offshore oil and gas drilling on some 253 million hectares of federal waters. That covers most U.S. coastal waters.
I will reverse it immediately. It'll be done immediately.
U.S. President-elect Donald Trump quickly vowed to undo the ban and ramp up offshore drilling after he takes office on January 20th.
And we will drill, baby, drill. We're going to be drilling in a lot of other locations, and the energy costs are going to come way down.
But legal experts say it may not be easy to reverse the ban because it would likely require an act of Congress. Meanwhile, environmentalists say the new prohibition will help fight climate change. Ali Rosenbluth, U.S. campaign co-manager at the advocacy group Oil Change International via Skype.
Science has made clear that any expansion of fossil fuels is incompatible with keeping warming of our world below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the threshold that was set in the Paris Agreement to keep wildfires, hurricanes, other climate disasters from escalating.
Trump has previously expressed skepticism about man-made climate change. And advocates for the offshore energy industry praise the president-elect's stance. Eric Mulito is president of the National Ocean Industries Association. He spoke via Skype.
The demand is at 100 million barrels per day for the global economy. And if we're not going to produce that energy here in the U.S., it's going to get produced somewhere. And we believe we have high standards when it comes to environmental protection.
Professor of Marine Biology at Duke University, Andy Reid, acknowledges the world needs oil for now. Reid was interviewed via Skype.
We can't instantaneously transition to non-carbon-based sources of energy. So it will take a long time. And if, even if the pendulum is swinging backwards a little bit now, I think the long-term perspective is going to be towards cleaner sources of energy.
And he adds, the transition to greener energy will happen with or without U.S. leadership. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
We reported on Tuesday's show that French troops will leave Ivory Coast and Senegal. In a related story, anti-French sentiments are on the rise in West and Central Africa. Chad's government has reiterated its order for French troops to completely withdraw from the country by the end of this month. The order follows remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron, who said African countries are ungrateful for France's role in helping to fight extremist insurgencies. Moki Edwin Kinzeka filed this report from Yaoundé, narrated for us by Scott Walterman.
Secondary school teacher Hassan Debonge says it's high time African countries assume full independence by ordering French troops out of their territories and making sure France does not exploit them economically. The 32-year-old says Africans are capable of reorganizing their armies and protecting their territories without the presence of what he calls the exploitative French troops. Hassan spoke in Chad's capital on Wednesday as several hundred youths assembled to express their dissatisfaction at French President Emmanuel Macron's comments during a speech on Monday. Macron said France did the right thing by deploying its military to the Sahel region, but said the region failed to say thank you. Macron said the states of the Sahel region would have fallen under the control of jihadist insurgencies and would not be sovereign today without French intervention. Macron's statement sparked a wave of anger and disbelief across Africa. Chad's president, Mahadris Idriss Deby, said Tuesday, Macron's declaration dishonors and disrespects Africa. Deby accused Macron of being in the wrong era. And he said France has until the end of January to completely withdraw its troops from Chad. A special commission created by Chad's government to supervise the withdrawal of French troops also met in the capital. Chad's Prime Minister, Alame Halina, chaired the meeting. He says Macron's statements are an insult to Africa, which deployed over 200,000 soldiers conscripted from French colonies to help France in battles against Nazi Germany during World War II. He says without the Africans, who Macron describes today as ingrates, France would have been defeated in the war. Alina says France has never given significant assistance to Chadian troops, adding that Paris has often focused only on achieving what he called French strategic interests. France has always said its troops are in Africa to fight Islamic State and other terrorist groups. In 2012, French troops helped drive out Islamist militants who had seized control of northern Mali. But Senegal's Prime Minister, Osame Sonoko, says Macron's assertion that France is helping Africa to maintain peace and protect its sovereignty is erroneous. In addition to Chad, Senegal and Ivory Coast have demanded the departure of French troops from their territory. Chad says several hundred of the 1,000 French troops have left the Central African state just within the past month. France handed over its military base in northern Chad as part of the withdrawal last month, according to Chadian officials. For Moki Edwin Kinzeka in Cameroon, I'm Scott Walterman, VOA News.
On Tuesday, Trump gave a press conference in which he said he would not rule out using the U.S. military to take Greenland from Denmark and reasserting U.S. control over the Panama Canal. For a look at what this might mean for American foreign policy going forward, Steve spoke with Dan Hamilton, a non-resident senior fellow for foreign policy at the Center for the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution.
Donald Trump said that he would not rule out using the military to take Greenland from Denmark, to take the Panama Canal back from Panama. We can't get inside his head. We don't know if he was actually serious or not. But if he was, this represents a massive shift in American foreign policy, no?
Well, I think one has to look exactly the context of what was said. He's conflating different topics. So first of all, I think it's typical of Donald Trump, sort of bombastic declarations that often don't prove to be, come true in any serious way later. It's also a way to disorient potential opponents and also, frankly, the media. So they focus on these kinds of statements rather than what he's really doing. It's also, I think, a tried and true tactic to bully others, to put them on the back foot in advance of negotiations. So I think one has to pick apart the different topics and then understand what he's probably trying to say here.
Okay, so let's do that. Let's start with Greenland, if that's okay.
If you think about what he's done, what's serious is to highlight the importance of Greenland in the world that we're facing. It's a major repository of critical minerals at a time when the United States is very dependent on China for those materials. It is part of the Arctic, which is becoming a area of contestation with both Russia and China as we go forward.
Is this really the best way for him to get what he wants?
He clearly would want the United States to have better access to, and maybe privileged access to, Greenland's critical materials and minerals. He will want to exclude China from any access to that. The Chinese are very active there. And he would want to set up a new kind of relationship with both Denmark and Greenland to position the United States, in the Arctic space that's much more advantageous to the United States.
So you're not concerned about the use of the American military to achieve these ends?
I believe, frankly, the force issue had more to deal with the Panama Canal, which is a different history and different topic.
So let's talk about that. Let's change gears and move to Panama.
So today, the Panama Canal is a major choke point or waterway for the world's commercial flows. And on either side of the canal, the administration is being done by Chinese companies. So China has, this is what the president-elect has referred to as China having some role here. Over time, Panama has allowed Chinese companies to administer port authorities and related activities to the canal. And I believe the president is referring to this to say, basically, a message to China, back off. And we have every right, actually, under the neutrality treaty, if we feel that China is abusing that authority, to actually intervene militarily. He doesn't say all of that, but that is clearly within the U.S. prerogative to do so, should it interpret it as violating this neutrality of the Panama Canal.
He said before he thinks Canada ought to be the 51st U.S. state. That no doubt ruffled some feathers in Ottawa. What do you think his end goal is there? What was he trying to achieve with that?
Well, there again, it seems to me, this is speculation, of course, as I said, back to tried and true tactics. He's trying to get a better deal with Canada on a whole range of issues. He doesn't believe Canada is paying its fair share of defense. It is a NATO ally, but way below the 2% defense spending threshold. That's sort of now considered the floor of any NATO ally contribution. He believes the trade balance with Canada is not to U.S. advantage. He has pointed, again, threatened tariffs on Canada and Mexico to strike better deals within the USMCA. And so this is a typical Trumpian tactic. Put the other part on the negotiating table on the back foot, disorient them by all this kind of crazy talk, and then try to get a better deal because they'll be more willing to come to the negotiating table.
Daniel Hamilton is a non-resident senior fellow for foreign policy at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced and International Studies. Professor Hamilton, thanks so much for your analysis today.
Okay, thank you.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.